The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter and probably from the Harvard Health Letter, too. The first article comes from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, and this is the October 2022 issue, and it's an article about heart valve replacement, opening a new door to your heart's healthy function. You've recently been diagnosed with aortic stenosis, a narrowed aortic valve in your heart, which forces your heart to work harder than it should. Your doctor says that your condition and symptoms are severe enough to recommend surgery. Many heart valve problems can be surgically repaired, but for severe aortic stenosis and in certain other circumstances, valve replacement surgery is often the best option for returning to a healthy and active life. An open and shut case. Blood flows through the heart in a particular pattern to nourish the cells in the body. Blood enters through the right side of the heart, then goes out in the lungs where it picks up oxygen. Oxygen-rich blood then flows through the left side of the heart, which pumps it out to the rest of the body. The heart's valves are like one-way doors located at each end of the lower chambers of the heart, which are called ventricles. Each heart valve has two critical functions to open correctly, so that blood can leave a chamber and to close tightly so that no blood leaks backward. The four heart valves are the tricuspid valve, which allows blood flow from the top right chamber, the right atrium, to the lower right chamber, the right ventricle. The pulmonary valve, which opens as blood pumps from the right ventricle to the lungs through the pulmonary artery. And the mitral valve, which allows blood flow from the top left chamber, the left atrium, to the bottom left chamber, the left ventricle. Finally, there's the aortic valve, which opens as blood leaves the heart from the left ventricle through the aorta and flows out to the rest of the body. Each valve consists of flexible flaps known as leaflets or cusps. When working correctly, these flaps open and close once during each heartbeat. Heart valves typically have three leaflets, except for the mitral valve, which has two. Heart valve troubles. Heart valve disease occurs when one or more valves don't work properly. This causes the blood flow through the heart to be disrupted or not efficient. There are two basic types of heart valve problems. First, there is narrowing of a valve, which is also called stenosis. This may be present at birth, which is called a congenital heart defect, or it can result from a buildup of calcium deposits over time, or from scar tissue that may form due to an infection like rheumatic fever. The other thing that can happen is a leaking valve. A number of problems can cause valve flaps to not close tightly and allow blood to flow backward, causing regurgitation. These include a backward bulging of the valve called prolapse, congenital heart changes, a heart attack, an infection of the lining of the heart called endocarditis, and thickened heart muscle called a cardiomyopathy. Heart valve disease tends to gradually worsen. It can sneak up slowly. You can have a faulty valve but not develop symptoms for decades. But for some people, symptoms may develop very quickly. Common symptoms include chest pain, excessive or unusual fatigue, the inability to maintain typical activity levels, shortness of breath, passing out, and swelling in the ankles, feet, or abdomen. Your healthcare provider may notice a whooshing sound, which is called a murmur, when listening to your heart with a stethoscope. Heart valve disease is lifelong, Medications cannot reverse the condition, though they may be used alongside lifestyle changes to alleviate symptoms and reduce the risk of complications. But still, the primary treatment is surgery. The decision to repair or replace a damaged valve depends on many things, including the type and severity of valve disease, your age and overall health, and whether surgery is needed to correct another valve or heart condition. In general, experts recommend valve repair when possible. Repair may involve adding, removing, or reshaping tissue to restore valve function. Repair procedures lower the risk of infection, save the existing heart valve, and may improve heart function. But in many situations, valve replacement is the most effective option. The aortic valve and mitral valve are the most commonly replaced heart valves. People who are in good overall health are often candidates for open heart surgery to replace a valve. Generally, they include adults under age 65, although the surgery can be considered for some between the ages of 65 and 80. An open heart valve replacement involves general anesthesia. You'll be connected to a heart-lung bypass machine, which keeps blood moving through your body during the procedure. Valve replacement involves removing the faulty valve and replacing it with a tissue-based or bioprosthetic valve or a mechanical prosthetic valve. Tissue-based valves come from human, pig, or cow tissue. These valves can wear out over time, but advances have improved their durability. These valves will end up lasting about 10 to 20 years. Mechanical valves tend to last longer, often for a lifetime, and provide a higher rate of long-term survival. But mechanical valves require you to take anti-clotting drugs for the rest of your life to prevent blood clots from forming that can obstruct the valve or break free and block a blood vessel. Your doctor can discuss the risks and benefits of each type in more detail. Complications with valve surgery are generally uncommon, but may include bleeding, heart attack, infection, irregular heartbeat, and stroke. Further, valve surgery may be needed as the heart valve ages. Some people need heart valve replacement but are not able to undergo open heart surgery due to a high risk of complications. For aortic valve disease, these people may benefit from a less invasive procedure called transcatheter aortic valve replacement. This is abbreviated TAVR and is also called transcatheter aortic valve implantation. TAVR, remember that's transcatheter aortic valve replacement, is similar to placing a stent in the heart. Unlike with open heart surgery, there is no need for a bypass machine, and TAVR can often be completed without general anesthesia. In TAVR, a doctor inserts a catheter in the groin or chest and guides it to the heart. A replacement valve is then inserted through the catheter to the heart. A balloon may expand the valve, or some valves can self-expand. Once the new valve is expanded, it pushes the old valve leaflets out of the way to take over the job of regulating blood flow. Doctors may also perform a catheter procedure to insert a replacement valve into a previously implanted tissue-based valve that is no longer working properly. In 2019, the Food and Drug Administration extended its approval of TAVR, opening up the option to people with severe aortic stenosis who have lower surgical risk. The change came after recent research showed that many significant outcomes of TAVR, including the risk of rehospitalization, stroke and death were equal to or better than those of open surgery after 1 to 2 years. But more study needs to be done to confirm whether this distinction holds, as the long-term durability of these valves are still uncertain. This leaves questions about the long-term benefit for younger people with a longer life expectancy. The average number of TAVR procedures performed now exceeds aortic valve replacements done with open heart surgery. TAVR is preferred for people over age 80, but it can be considered for those 65 and older. A transcatheter approach to mitral valve replacement is also being investigated. In addition, other types of minimally invasive treatments, including robot and video-assisted procedures, continue to be refined. A heart valve replacement can allow you to resume a healthy, active life. Immediately after the procedure, you may spend a day or more in the intensive care unit, and several days afterward in the hospital. So your healthcare team can monitor your vital signs, manage your pain, and help you recover. Many people who have had TAVR are able to go home the next day. Your care team will advise you on whether you can return to daily activities like lifting, working, driving, and exercise. A typical recovery time is 4 to 8 weeks. Although it may be less with minimally invasive surgery. 1 week is common with TAVR. You will typically need regular health checkups to monitor your heart condition and to check for complications like valve failure. Imaging tests may be done to make sure the new valve is working correctly. After heart valve surgery, it's important to follow a heart-healthy lifestyle. Eat a healthy and varied diet. Get regular exercise, manage your weight, reduce stress, and don't smoke. Your care provider may recommend cardiac rehabilitation. This structured program of education and exercise can improve your overall health and help you to fully recover. Now let's go over a much shorter article entitled Health Tips, and it's subtitled Prune Benefits. Prunes, or dried plums, have a well-earned reputation as a constipation remedy. They contain insoluble fiber, soluble fiber, and sorbitol, a natural sweetener that acts like a laxative. But the benefits don't end there. Prunes fight inflammation, provide potassium and antioxidants, and may even help postmenopausal women fend off bone loss. Try adding prunes to your diet by starting with prunes. Toss a few halves into your morning bowl of granola, low-fat yogurt, or oatmeal. A quarter cup of prune puree can take the place of an egg when baking. Just include an additional half teaspoon of baking powder for leavening. Prunes can also be used to add natural sweetness to your salad or smoothie. Prunes also add complexity to Brussels sprouts, pasta, chicken, pork, pizza, and more. Pureed prunes with broth and vinegar will work as an effective meat glaze. Blending the puree with olive oil, balsamic vinegar, and Dijon mustard turns it into a vinaigrette. With rice vinegar, soy sauce, garlic, and ginger, prune puree becomes a sauce that pairs well with Asian dishes. When adding prunes to your diet, remember to go slow. Increasing fiber too fast can result in bloating and gas. Care for your kidneys. Some people with kidney problems need to restrict their dietary potassium, and prunes are high in potassium. Watch the portions. Prunes are a more concentrated source of sugar and calories than fresh fruit. A half cup of prunes has 210 calories and 33 grams of sugar. For a quick snack, grab 3 to 5 prunes. Now, continuing with the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, I'm going to read an article called I melanoma. And next to the article, there's a picture which says, you can develop eye melanoma in the colored portion around the pupil, the layer of blood vessels and connective tissue that lines the back of the eye, and the muscle fibers around the eye's lens that help the eye focus. Now, the article about eye melanoma. You may think that melanoma is synonymous with skin cancer. While that's usually the case, melanoma can also develop in and around the eye. There are key differences between eye melanoma and melanoma of the skin. For instance, while a strange-looking mole can tip you off to possible skin cancer, most melanomas involving the eye aren't visible on the front of the eye. Most eye melanomas have a completely different molecular basis than skin melanomas, so they respond differently to treatment. And eye melanomas don't happen nearly as often as skin melanomas, but they're the top eye cancer among adults and can spread to other parts of the body. There are multiple types of eye melanomas, and they differ greatly. Symptoms, survival rates, and treatment options all vary depending on where the melanoma forms. Eye removal is no longer the standard treatment, but it's still necessary in some cases, and other treatments may result in partial vision loss. Remember that a melanoma is a cancer of the cells that make melanin, the pigment responsible for the color of your skin. You also have these melanin-producing cells in your eye, as well as in your nose and your throat. A melanoma in the middle layer of the eye, also called the uvea, may involve the colored portion around the pupil, which is also called the iris, or it could involve the muscle fibers around the lens, or the layer of blood vessels and connective tissue that lines the back of the eye called the choroid. You also can develop melanoma in the clear outer layer of the eye and the lining of the eyelid. Older adults and people with white skin are more likely to develop eye melanoma. Having blue or green eyes or the skin disorder dysplastic nevus syndrome puts you at a higher risk of uveal melanoma. Ultraviolet light exposure is thought to increase the risk of conjunctival melanoma, but it's not clear whether this exposure increases uveal melanoma risk as well. All older adults, regardless of risk, should have regular dilated eye exams. An eye specialist may find an eye melanoma before symptoms occur. If a problem is found with an eye exam, various imaging scans can aid diagnosis. Imaging options for uveal melanoma includes eye ultrasound, pictures of the eye's blood vessels taken after a special dye is injected, called an angiogram, and an imaging test known as optical coherence tomography. Optical coherence tomography also can be used to image a conjunctival melanoma. Removing a piece of eye tissue for analysis is necessary to diagnose conjunctival melanoma, but not to diagnose uveal melanoma. A biopsy may provide valuable information about chromosomal changes in the tumor. An examination of certain chromosomes in the tumor may help determine whether you have a higher risk of your eye melanoma spreading. Also, genetic profile of the tumor. An examination of the gene expression profile of your tumor can quantify the risk of your melanoma spreading within 5 years. The gene test will place you in a low, intermediate, or high-risk category. Other tests and imaging scans like CT scans, MRI scans, or positron emission tomography, the PET scan, can examine other areas of your body for melanoma. Treatment differs depending on how big the tumor is and where it's located. One possible treatment is radiation therapy. In a procedure called brachytherapy, B-R-A-C-H-Y-T-H-E-R-A-P-Y, a surgeon attaches a small metal disc of radioactive seeds to your eye. The plaque looks like a bottle cap and is surgically removed after about 4 or 5 days. Alternatively, you can receive proton beam radiation from a machine. Radiation side effects include dry eye, cataracts, glaucoma, and vision changes. Another treatment is called non-invasive treatment. Though not usually a primary treatment, extreme cold or cryotherapy, an infrared laser or thermotherapy, or photodynamic therapy may be used. Photodynamic therapy involves a medication to make cancer cells vulnerable to light, and then a certain wavelength of light is applied to cells and blood vessels to damage them. Another possible treatment is surgery. For melanoma of the iris or conjunctiva, it may be possible to remove the tumor while keeping some of the eye's healthy tissue intact. When uveal melanomas are too large, it may be necessary to remove the whole eye. This is a process called enucleation, E-N-U-C-L-E-A-T-I-O-N. For some extensive conjunctival melanomas, it's necessary to remove nearby tissues along with the eye in a process called excenteration. After the eye is removed, an artificial eye may be implanted. If the eye muscles can be safely left in place, the prosthesis is connected to the muscles so that the prosthesis will be able to move. After treatment, you'll need regular checkups to make sure the tumor has not come back or spread. Mayo Clinic experts recommend monitoring for 15 years for uveal melanoma and 5 years for conjunctival melanoma. Radiation treatment can cause a slow loss of vision over several years. Many people who have undergone radiation therapy eventually end up with 20/200 vision or worse. Surgically removing an eye alters your peripheral vision and depth perception. It may take a few months or longer to adapt to your new limited vision. An occupational therapist can help. Vision changes or the loss of an eye can lead to feelings of sadness or grief. You may need additional help like a support group or mental health therapy. Mayo Clinic experts say that people who experience vision changes generally adapt very well with a little time and patience. With very few exceptions, like commercial driving or piloting a plane, they can do everything they could do before their vision change or eye loss. Now continue with the Mayo Clinic newsletter. Here's a brief story called News and Our Views. Improved Alzheimer's Diagnosis in African Americans. In a recent study published in eBiomedicine, Mayo Clinic researchers identified an avenue to potentially improve the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease in African Americans using simple blood tests. Together with recent advances in blood markers of Alzheimer's, the findings could eventually translate into testing that has improved accuracy, is more cost-effective, is easier on individuals, and has wider availability than current screening measures. Mayo researchers examined the blood of 400 African Americans who either had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's or had no cognitive impairment. The researchers found that measuring levels of 6 specific RNA molecules in the blood increased their ability to identify the study participants with Alzheimer's by 8% over standard predictive models. An Alzheimer's diagnosis often involves MRI or magnetic resonance imaging or PET or positron emission tomography scans. These provide detailed pictures of the brain, but they can be expensive and are not definitive for diagnosis. In some cases, healthcare providers may also recommend testing the cerebrospinal fluid for certain proteins thought to be important in Alzheimer's. Researchers hope that having additional biomarkers to use in screening may help detect Alzheimer's early and lead to treatments that can delay or lessen the severity of the disease. This is particularly true for African Americans, who are twice as likely as non-Hispanic whites to develop dementia, yet are often underrepresented in studies and other underrepresented communities. Next is an article called Eating Wild Game, and attached to this article is a tip from the Mayo Clinic chef, Jennifer Welper. She says, use an accurate high-quality thermometer when cooking game. You worked hard for the hunt, and I would hate for you to overcook it. Proper internal cooking is a must. Cook venison steak or roast to 145 degrees. Avoid going much over that to retain tenderness. Cook ground venison to at least 165 degrees. Game birds are generally done at 165 degrees. And we'll continue with this article about eating wild game on our next session. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.